from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, the American Psychiatric Association voted this past weekend to remove the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome from the so-called Bible of Psychiatry, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders. People with Asperger's will now more likely be diagnosed as having autism spectrum disorder, and the APA says the change will lead to more accurate diagnoses for people with autism. But critics say removing the diagnosis may result in fewer people getting the services and care they need. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. This past weekend, following 7 years of debate, the American Psychiatric Association made major changes for the first time in nearly 20 years to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Disorders, which is used worldwide in the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. Under the new guidelines of the fifth edition, diagnosis of Asperger's will now be subsumed by the category of autism spectrum disorders, potentially affecting millions of children and adults in such areas as insurance and special education needs. According to the APA, this was done to help more accurately and consistently to diagnose children with autism and to provide appropriate treatments. But the decision to exclude Asperger's definitely has its critics and those in opposition to the APA decision. And the new manual is slated for publication in May, and we want to find out what the effects are likely to be in this opening hour. We take up the debate. Joining us, Emily Willingham. She's freelance science writer and editor and blogs at Forbes and has written about this and is a parent of an autistic son who was diagnosed with Asperger's and is with us this morning from up in northern Colorado. Welcome, Emily Willingham. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, good to have you here. I guess let's spell this out for listeners because we're talking about a decision which erases what was viewed as arbitrary distinctions on the spectrum, and there will be now pretty much an overlap of people, of those who were once considered different by dint of having Asperger's. And I'm just curious to know at this point how you see this, particularly in terms of kind of lumping things into a different category, or one category as being subsuming Asperger's.
It's a good question, and it's actually one that I asked on our Thinking Person's Guide to Autism Facebook site, and the responses that we got actually reflect, I think, several different perspectives on this. It just depends on your perspective. There is a scientific interpretation of this in that it sort of effaces what a lot of people think were arbitrary boundaries for these diagnoses. But there's also a personal interpretation, especially for people who have identified as having Asperger's, and they feel that this effaces them rather than those boundaries. And then there are these considerations I think parents are particularly worried about with the practical repercussions having to do, especially with children who maybe have to come up for reevaluations in the school system for services and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think those distinctions are pretty much the sort of response many of us who are reading about this are having. I mean, on the one hand, the science that's been presented by APA says they can't find meaningful differences as a result of the research, and the boundaries are fluid and changes are justified. On the other hand, you have people saying, well, I had Asperger's and now I'm being labeled with the stigma of autism.
Well, I think there's a small subset of people who sort of perceive this as what you call the stigma of autism. But I think in general, from my personal experience anyway, that a lot of people who have Asperger's self-identify as autistic, period. And so from that perspective, they don't really see, you know, a problem with sort of making this an umbrella situation.
And the senses of, you alluded to this before just a moment ago, but concern about people not getting services and falling through the cracks here, just how much are they to be worried about that?
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of concern. In fact, most of the concern that I see that's sort of, you know, not very thrilled about this change is among parents. They're particularly worried that, you know, if their child comes up for reevaluation in school, which does happen, that the schools will take advantage of this as a chance to deny services, or that there will be some sort of requirement for strict interpretation of these guidelines from insurance. So this could go either way, and it really probably is going to be very school specific. If the school takes the guidelines as they are and it sort of applies them more generally, then they will actually catch more children. But if they take them and apply them in ways that studies seem to show will exclude at least 10% of children currently diagnosed under DSM-IV guidelines, then we're going to lose children who might need and probably very much do need services and academic support.
Again, Emily Willingham is with us by phone from up in Northern Colorado, and she's a freelance writer, science writer, and an editor, and blogs at Forbes and has written about this on Forbes.com. She's also a parent of an autistic son who is diagnosed with Asperger's. Is this going to change life for your son, do you think?
You know, I asked him about that, and he's in the sort of category of people. He's 11, and he was diagnosed with this just before he turned 4, and he has really come to identify with this. And so I think he's in the category of people who sort of feels like it's mystifying to think that, you know, one day this existed and the next day it doesn't. And he has no problem describing himself or being described as autistic, but this Asperger's thing was really an identity for him as well.
Well, I want to bring in a couple of other people to speak with us this morning on this panel. Michael John Carley is Executive Director of GRASP, the Global and Regional Asperger Syndrome Partnership. He's in New York. He's also the author of Asperger's From the Inside Out and was diagnosed with Asperger's at 36 when his young son was diagnosed. Michael John Carley, good to have you on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate you having me on.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Stephen Kapp, who's with us from Los Angeles. He's a PhD student in developmental psychology at UCLA and a member of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. He was diagnosed with Asperger's when he was 13, but has since preferred to identify himself as autistic. Stephen Kapp, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you here. And Michael John Carley, let me talk about your opposition to this. Why are you opposed?
Well, we're opposed mainly because of the danger of people losing their diagnosis under the criteria. There's really two separate issues of controversy involving this, one of which is the semantics of the name change of everybody, you know, with Asperger's or PDD-NOS changing over into, you know, referring to themselves as having autism. And the second of which is, that was a story that broke earlier this year, was that, you know, potentially up to 40% of people on the spectrum would lose their diagnosis under the criteria as it was written. Now, as a non-clinician, I can't, you know, verify or not verify whether or not these changes are accurate. But I think if you're leaning the conversation towards the actual first controversy, which is just umbrellaing everything under the auspices of autism spectrum disorder, and somebody like myself switching from Asperger's to autism, I would say, first off, representing GRASP's membership, and GRASP is, for those who don't know us, we're the largest membership organization in the world of adults diagnosed on the spectrum. And usually in the controversial issues, our membership is unanimous on things. And on this particular issue, they were split 50-50. A lot of people saw some logic to making the change. A lot of people really were reluctant to give up the word Asperger's in their life. They really sort of absorbed it into a lot of their identity. So, you know, speaking personally, with regard to just the name change, I actually don't disagree with it. I think it's going to be very problematic, especially in the short term, for a lot of the reasons that Emily has already described, but also because I do think there's still a negative stigma to autism, and it's because we in the autism community have still done a really bad job of stopping the idea of treating this just as a national tragedy, which to us, it's a services crisis, and it's not a health crisis. A lot of us forget, I think, that the word Asperger's had really negative stigma like around 12 years ago when my son and I were diagnosed. And because we've changed as a society and not because the condition changed, there's a lot more positive that's summoned when you immediately think of that word in your head than you would have 12 years ago. And I think that if everybody is diagnosed with autism, that actually that's something that's going to happen for the words autism later on in life as well. It also makes sense because really every clinical attempt to draw a line in the sand to separate autism and Asperger's has really been proven false in practice. And we're human beings. We really like to compartmentalize. We have a really hard time swallowing the idea that all these famous people being diagnosed in retrospect, like Albert Einstein, Beethoven, Emily Dickinson, could possibly have just shades of the same condition as somebody who might not talk and lives in a home somewhere. We have a really hard time swallowing that.
Well, except, and I think you've kind of suggested this, that there are many who have the diagnosis of Asperger's who are high functioning, maybe not so much in social skills as is often the case. But I was reading Gary Burge, who said this sets the whole journey back. It removes a label that assists people to understand who they are, and it's going to be harder for them to get employment, and they're subject to perhaps more stereotypes now that they're labeled as autistic.
Well, that's the danger of the short term. And, you know, there's that. There's, you know, the adjustment period of services and what school boards and what service agencies that are really budget strapped are maybe going to try and manipulate these changes for their economical betterment. It is a very, very large short-term worry.
But you're more optimistic for the long term, and that's heartening to hear. You've also, I believe, called for maybe more scientific review. I mean, there's a lot of criticism, DSM-4, that even blasted by some of the people who led that research, that there was laziness in the committee that did the protocols.
Yeah, mostly the chief architect of the DSM-4, Dr. Alan Francis out of Duke University, he doesn't waste any chance he gets to basically really criticize the working habits as well as the conclusions of the DSM-5 committee. And this, for us, refers to more along the lines of the possibility that people will lose their diagnosis, whether it's autism or Asperger's or whatever it is, which to us is a much more deeper concern than just, you know, the semantics and iconography of a name change.
But the focus could be perhaps more on deficits rather than labels in the long term. I think that's what you're saying, isn't it?
I'm not sure what you mean by that question.
Deficit. Well, in other words, here's this wide spectrum, and it's always been fluid, and it's perhaps if everything comes under that wide spectrum, you can talk about things more individually, even though there may be more people excluded as a result.
Yes, absolutely. But in addition to that, I think that, you know, if this change over the long haul forces we human beings who do like to compartmentalize into finally accepting that this stuff is just so much more complicated than any of us instinctively want it to be, then I think that's a good thing.
Again, Michael Giancarli with us from New York, Executive Director of GRASP, the Global and Regional Asperger's Syndrome Partnership. He's also the author of Asperger's From the Inside Out. And Stephen Kapp is a PhD student in developmental psychology at UCLA, member of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, who was, as I said earlier, diagnosed with Asperger's when he was 13 years old. But you prefer identification with autism, and so this is a good decision by you, Stephen. Why?
Well, I think that I agree that there are two main issues, that there's identity politics and concerns about stigma on one hand, and concerns about people who might lose a diagnosis on the autism spectrum altogether and possibly lose services, and I see those issues as separate. And as far as stigma, I think that there are some groups and individuals who may think that there's something superior about either the Asperger's diagnosis or the people who are diagnosed with it, and create some separatism, and I think that creates a lot of stigma within the autism community and more generally. But as far as why I support the consolidation of the specific autism spectrum diagnoses into one broad diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, well, the autism spectrum can be diagnosed pretty accurately when taken as a whole, but Asperger's, well, actually, there's no validity to trying to cut up the autism spectrum to creating subtypes or subdiagnoses, despite so many different studies and efforts by scientists. And so Asperger's is an invalid diagnosis, both in its design and practice. So many people get diagnosed with it who meet criteria for autistic disorder, and which diagnosis people get within the autism spectrum has a lot to do with unscientific factors like which clinic they go to or where they live or many other very problematic things. And in California and many other states, people are denied services because they have an Asperger rather than autistic disorder diagnosis, not for their individual needs. So the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network has released two public policy briefs on our website, autisticadvocacy.org, that I've co-written, and one of them analyzed the potential impact on law, policy, and service provision. And so for school services or accommodations, non-discrimination and accommodations more generally, Medicaid-funded developmental disability services, and Social Security, on balance, integrating into one diagnosis should help people who currently have Asperger's and PDD-NOS diagnoses, as long as the diagnosis is broad and inclusive enough and that the diagnostic practices are comprehensive enough to still include them.
Well, forgive me, Stephen, a lot is going to depend, obviously, on how clinicians use these this new diagnostic spectrum, and it's going to be probably a lot of trial and error, though I wonder, people who need less, some are saying will get less with this one-size-fits-all.
Well, I do agree that a lot does come down, no matter how, even if the criteria is relaxed, for example, and we have various specific recommendations in another brief that we've proposed, that a lot does come down to clinical interpretation. And the work group that survives the criteria said, I've attended or watched about 10 presentations by the work group on the proposal, and I've also read several academic articles or letters by them. And it does require more, it does put more pressure on clinical interpretation to do a very thorough and comprehensive job, because now there is little room for error, because they're proposing that all three of three social communication subdomains must be met, change from two of four, and there are so these are broad principles, and there's a non-exhaustive list of examples that could be, that clinicians could come up with. So the clinician, it's up to the clinician to be responsible to determine how, based on someone's age or gender or various circumstances that they have to think about, how the different criteria apply to the person. And I think there is more that can be done to try to help with understanding what are different manifestations across the lifespan and other variations, and to try to improve diagnostic practice itself. For example, requiring that, I mean, this is me personally, I think that if you require observation, clinical observation as well as report, and criteria to be met from either, if it's publicly said, you know, that it's acknowledged that if someone just goes into a pediatrician's office or whatever, a doctor's office for a 15-minute visit, or someone just, a generalist does like a quick checklist or something, and they don't really consider how people's behaviors may differ in various contexts, and how people over time may develop compensatory strategies.
Well, as you say, a lot is going to depend on who the clinician is and how, inclusive the whole view of the patient is. Speaking about inclusivity, by the way, again, Stephen Kapp is with us from Los Angeles. He's a member of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. I want to bring our listeners into this and get your response to Asperger's syndrome no longer being an official diagnosis. The American Psychiatric Association voted on that this weekend, and they have removed the diagnosis of Asperger's from the so-called Bible of Psychiatry, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Psychiatric Disorders. Please feel free to join us in conversation here. In fact, we welcome your calls and your emails. You can do that now toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The toll-free number is 866-733-6786. And again, you can join the program live, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, and we'll bring you into the conversation. And we certainly welcome your contributions to what we're talking about and your responses to the American Psychiatric Association's decision. I want to go back just for a moment, though, Emily Willingham, to you and find out about the study that was done by Yale professors that this DSM change will leave a large percentage of people without an autism diagnosis.
There were several studies that have been done, and some of them have showed exclusions of people currently diagnosed that go as high as, I mean, close to 50%. The one that most recently came out was actually, I think Catherine Lord was one of the authors on that. I think she's part of the working group for the DSM-5. And that one found, and that is, this is their own sort of analysis of this, that one found that at least 1 in 10 would be excluded. And the issue here is that I think the goal of these revised criteria for the DSM, which, by the way, at this point has become the rotary phone of diagnostic guides, is that they were trying really hard to be more specific about whom they identified, but they end up excluding people by targeting that specificity. And so the studies vary. There are lots of studies. There is the one out of Yale that has a fairly high percentage. There is the one recently, the Lord study, that had 10%, and then there are values up and down the spectrum between those two.
Well, I wanted to get some comments on here from our Facebook page. First of all, Michelle says, our entire family is on the spectrum. It is not a disease. And Teresa says, I think it can be a good thing if people could start seeing that autism is suffered in degrees. And Jeanette says on our Facebook page, how could this affect families with children that have been diagnosed with this condition? Would it make them ineligible for special assistance in school and beyond? And there's one of the big questions that looms, Emily William.
Yeah, I mean, it is a big question. And, I mean, nobody can answer that question right now because we can't predict how people are really going to apply these guidelines in practice, which, you know, calls into question how relevant this ultimately will end up being. If you can undo existing diagnosis in a matter of, you know, between two DSM volumes, I think that means clinicians are kind of just doing what they want to do. And as Steve pointed out, it's going to vary wildly among clinicians and their level of expertise and so forth and so on.
Well, we're coming up on a break, and when we return, we'll go to your calls and emails. I want to remind you that you can join us by going to our Facebook page as well, or kqed.org/forum on our website. And this is not only the only decision, by the way. I mean, we're focusing on the decision to have Asperger's syndrome no longer as an official diagnosis, but you may want to go online, the American Psychiatric Association's website, and you will discover that a hoarding disorder has now been added to new diagnosis, DMDD, that is disruptive mood disorder, and there are a number of other things that have been added. The children with tantrums between the ages of 6 and 10. This is now actually seen as a syndrome, as is something called excoriation, skin picking disorder associated with grief. And gender identity disorder, as it was formerly called, has now been replaced with gender dysphoria. So, and binge eaters, I mean, there are a lot of things that they decide on. As I said, these are the most major number of changes in nearly 20 years. But the big one, Asperger's, no longer there. And we'll talk more about it and hear from you when we return on Forum, talking with Emily Willingham, freelance science writer and editor who blogs at Forbes, Michael John Carley, executive director of GRASP, and Stephen Kapp, who is a member of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on Asperger's syndrome, which will no longer be an official diagnosis, according to the new American Psychiatric Association Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on Psychiatric Disorders. People with Asperger's will now be more likely to be diagnosed as having autism spectrum disorder, and the APA says the change will lead to more accurate diagnoses for people with autism. Critics say removing the diagnosis may result in fewer people getting the services and the care that they need. We have a whole panel with us, and we're going to be speaking shortly with one of those involved in the decision by the APA. Let me get a caller on here, and that's you, Edie. Join us. Morning.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. My son has Asperger's syndrome, and he was really wasn't like everyone else, or he was a little different when he was about 3 and a half. We took him into a developmental pediatrician, and she said that he had, I thought it was Asperger's, and she said, no, it's possible Tourette's and dyslexia. So he went his whole life until he got to high school with that diagnosis. And when we were in high school, we knew he was a little different, and everyone was a very supportive school he went through, K-8. But when we got into high school, they said, you need to have him retested. So we actually took him back to a neuropsychologist, and she came back just 2 years ago, actually, and she knew this change was coming. So she gave him the Asperger's diagnosis, but really the autistic diagnosis. And obviously, we have lots of friends with it, and obviously, I think some of my family has it. But my point is that, we have other friends that have, kids with PDD, and I just don't think taking it out, putting it into the autistic spectrum is going to be right, because my son is extremely high-functioning. He's very brilliant. But, our friend with PDD can barely talk. So it just seems really not right. It seems, I know compartmentalizing is, looked frowned upon, but I think it helps to get the right services for my son. If he's bucketed in with the PDD kids that are having a hard time, even though they're, it's a developmental, they're not going to be able to grow as much as my son.
No, Edie, I think your concern is the concern of many parents whose children were diagnosed or have been diagnosed with Asperger's. And in fact, let me bring Sally Rogers in and get a response from her. She's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at UC Davis's Mind Institute, and she was one of the 13 members of the Neurodevelopmental Disorders Work Group of the American Psychiatric Association, charged with developing the proposed revisions to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And there are many that were made here, like I said, more than we've seen in nearly 20 years. But this is the one that has certainly had the most spotlight on it, most attention. Sally Rogers, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Michael. And hi, Edie. It's nice to meet you by phone.
Well, what do you say to someone like Edie and many like her who feel that the subsuming of Asperger's may not only be a stigma, but it just doesn't seem right to them?
Mm-hmm. I understand the difficulties that it presents. And, there's certainly no effort in any of the work that we did on the committee to say to people, don't use the Asperger's label. If it's useful to you, it's descriptive. And it, it carries information, and certainly people can describe themselves however they want, and family members can use whatever terms they want. So, and I think that language appears in the text of the DSM-5. But I think the concern that you're raising is partly reflects a misunderstanding in the public about the relationship between cognitive function and the subgroupings that were in the DSM-4. And many, many people think that Asperger's syndrome describes people who have some characteristics of ASD in terms of social difficulties and repetitive behaviors or perseverative thinking, but that the Asperger's group are a group that have very high IQs and good cognitive skills, whereas the other subgroups don't, and that's a big difference. But that's actually not true, and that wasn't true in the DSM-4, that IQ doesn't play any part in any of the groupings that were in DSM-4. So people who met criteria for full autistic disorder could also range from people with very severe cognitive and language deficits to people who were brilliant, like your son is talking about. And the label PDDNOS was most often used for children who had high cognitive ability and good language but didn't have repetitive behavior. So the group of children that you know that you're describing who don't have very advanced language and have PDDOS, that's kind of an unusual combination.
So as you suggest, you won't, and I think this is important to emphasize, the Asperger's diagnosis will not be lost as a result of this. But is it possible, and likely even, that there will be a different focus that will perhaps even redefine what Asperger's was, traditionally, up until recently and up until this decision, identified with? ADD has changed, ADHD, homosexuality, all these things have gone through real changes in terms of being redefined.
Well, that actually the description of people who have Asperger's syndrome, the symptoms that they describe are very well characterized in the new DSM-5. But there are a couple of things that were happening that we thought were really made disadvantages for people with Asperger's. First of all, people were misusing the diagnosis. When people actually, in DSM-4, it said that people, if you use the Asperger's diagnosis, it meant that you did not meet criteria for autistic disorder. However, in reality, a huge percentage of people who were receiving Asperger's diagnosis, in fact, did meet autistic disorder, and clinicians were ignoring that because they did have this idea that that autistic disorder did not include people who are high functioning. So it kind of skewed our whole knowledge of what autism is. We stopped recognizing that autistic disorder, represents an entire spectrum of people, the majority of whom have good language and good cognitive skills. That was lost because of the way clinicians were misdiagnosing children.
I wonder, Michael Giancarlo, how you respond to what you just heard from Sally Rogers?
Well, it's very hard to listen to, and no disrespect intended, Ms. Rogers, but, you know, throughout the course of this past year, when the controversy hit with Fred Volkmar's study in January, we've heard so much contradictory information from various committee members about, no, there's not going to be anyone who loses their diagnosis, and then comments to state that there was overdiagnosis in the past and this is going to put a stop to that, or this is a cost issue, or, you know, a whole host of contradictions that many of the members have had. I think, too, that, you know, we're still in such a place where you could argue, I wouldn't, but you could argue that the condition is still somewhat underdiagnosed, especially in economically challenged communities, and in the way in which this stuff, you know, manifests itself in girls as opposed to boys. I think our knowledge is still in its infancy. And I do agree, though, with the unfortunately blanket statement when a parent is concerned about, will this affect my child, that there's simply no answer to that. I think not only is it going to depend on the child, I think that it is also going to depend on the clinician. And, you know, the other thing, you know, that Ms. Rogers, that I would say is that there's always going to be clinicians that misread the criteria for diagnosis, no matter which DSM they're going to be looking at. There are just, you know, there's some dumb doctors out there, and there's always going to be dumb doctors. So, you know, there is somewhat of a roll of a dice of this, and you're probably also, on a positive note, every once in a while going to approach a clinician whose main concern is to get the kid the services they need, as opposed to being black and white about the criteria.
Well, I want to read a comment from a listener, and then I want to go to more calls on our website, who pretty much agrees with some of the sentiments you just heard from Michael Giancarlo. Kathy writes, I'm a school psychologist, a mother of a teenage son who has Asperger's syndrome. I have ambivalent feelings about the removal of AS from the DSM-5. As a mother, I'm somewhat protective of the label because it's now part of my son's identity, and he's become proud, even a bit snobbish about having AS. That is Asperger's syndrome. He has some good arguments about the superiority of being neuroatypical. I'm less worried as a special educational professional because we have already been providing services to children with AS and will continue to under the category of autism. However, California's educational code has been woefully behind in its definition of this category. It relies on the old description of autism and does not yet encompass the wide spectrum of children who may need school-based services. And I'm a bit worried about how insurance companies might use the new category to deny services. We need to make sure our representatives stay on top of that. I guess it's all about change and flexibility, which is a challenge both for people on the autism spectrum and for the neurotypicals. Because of our increased knowledge and awareness, though, I'm hopefully optimistic. Let me bring a caller on here, and we go to Elizabeth. Join us.
Hi. My son is a 19-year-old who has been diagnosed with PDD-NOS quite late, just a couple of years ago. And he never received services through school, but he was eligible for services through the Department of Rehabilitation. And I'm just wondering, will people who have a current diagnosis that no longer exists be automatically re-diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, or do they need to go through a new evaluation if they are to receive further services.
Yeah, it's an important question because diagnoses are costly. And Sally Rogers, you shed some light on that?
That's a very good question. In terms of the coding, the numbers should be the same. So if people are using the ICD, the 299 code that goes with all of these spectrum disorders, whether it's autistic disorder, Asperger's, or PDD-OS, it shouldn't matter. But it may be that the group, like the rehabilitation center, will need to change the classification on paper from PDD-OS to autistic spectrum disorder. But the code should still fit. It shouldn't require a rediagnosis because the criteria, the diagnostic criteria that are written in DSM-5 should well cover your son as long as he has symptoms in both the social communicative area and the repetitive behavior area.
Let me thank the caller, and let me also go back to Stephen Kapp, because Stephen, I know you're a member of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, but you were diagnosed with Asperger's, so there was some free will here in deciding to identify as autistic.
Well, yes. I think it's not scientific. It's more inclusive as a community. It's more accurate. There are just so many systemic problems with the Asperger's diagnosis. And I actually, like many people, like most people who are diagnosed with Asperger's, I could go through a laundry list of problems with that diagnosis just from a scientific standpoint, but one is that I actually meet criteria for autistic disorder, and there's a rule that if you meet criteria for both, autism and Asperger's, you're supposed to be diagnosed with autistic disorder, but I wasn't, and I was denied for regional center services, for example, and
So, excuse me, you feel more comfortable with the autistic, what some would call it, label?
Yes, I think that is definitely, my identity is tied to being on the autism spectrum, not slicing and dicing in invalid ways. And I am concerned about the changes, about whether people actually might be missed, but I don't think we should be focusing on inaccurate headlines about articles about poorly designed studies and focus more on things like that new social communication disorder diagnosis, linking that to the broader autism spectrum.
Yeah, let me actually go to Dr. Rogers on it. Sally Rogers, let's clarify what this new social communication diagnosis is.
Mm-hmm. The social communication diagnosis, which is in the communication disorders, actually, it came from our discussions about the subgroups inside autism spectrum. And from the committee, early on, the committee's kind of recapitulation of what are the core symptoms in an autistic spectrum disorder, and that the core symptoms are the social communication symptoms and the repetitive behavior symptoms, or repetitive perseverative behavior symptoms. Those were the classic features of autism that have been described from the time Leo Kanner first identified children with ASD. And the PDD-NOS diagnosis was problematic in that it required symptoms in two of the three areas. But that meant that you could qualify on the basis of social and communication symptoms and not have any repetitive or perseverative behavior. And so when we reflected on this and said, do we want to include people in the autism spectrum disorder diagnosis who do not have any repetitive or perseverative behavior? We felt like that was wrong. That's not what the diagnosis means. That's not what the disorder is involved. That the hallmark of the disorder is that these two symptom clusters occur together. And so we recognize that there would be a subgroup of people who currently are diagnosed with PDD-NOS who do not have repetitive perseverative behavior, that in fact they do not meet this conceptual clustering of ASD, but they are people with disabilities. They need supports and care and treatment, and so they need an accurate diagnosis. And if their difficulties are in the social communication area, that seemed to be, that's a descriptive diagnosis for what their main symptoms are, and that it fits inside communication disorders. And it's interesting, people clinically had been using variants of this kind of diagnosis for a long time. Some people called it pragmatic language disorder. Some people called it semantic pragmatic disorder. These diagnoses appeared. They were never codified. They were never part of a system. But that group of people has always been there, and people have been trying to develop terms for them.
Well, we have one now. And again, Sally Rogers is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at UC Davis's Mind Institute, and she was one of the 13 members of the Neurodevelopmental Disorders Work Group of the American Psychiatric Association. Let me go with more of your calls, and Michelle joins us. Michelle, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. As the mother of a preschooler with a daughter with autistic disorder, I'm concerned that losing the distinctions will actually increase expectations for her as a child who does not have Asperger's, but rather autistic disorder, and what this means for her and the services she receives and her placement within the school district.
Well, your concern, and I thank you for expressing it, is, again, let me go back to Emily Willingham here, the concern of many parents.
I would say at preschool, it's hard to determine what anybody's potential is going to be, and that regardless of what the label is, it's our approach to this, and our son was, he had real limitations. He had one-on-one aids all the way through third grade until we started homeschooling him, and I think that the best thing to do is just to focus on mitigating whatever gaps child needs mitigated for academic success rather than having a concern about what the label itself might imply. And so in IEP meetings and so forth and so on, the best thing to do is to really home in on where those problems lie and to devise an appropriate program to address them.
Let me go to some of the comments that are coming in, and many are. Noelle writes on our website, I've also worked as a special education provider, and it continually worries me that schools are seen as the mainly sole provider of services for children on the Asperger's side of the spectrum. Autism and spectrum disorders need to be reclassified as neurological disorders, which they are, so that insurance companies will finally provide support along with school districts. To think that schools can carry this burden alone and do a thorough job is ridiculous. And Beth writes on our website, when I was around 8, my parents, who were in academia, were told I was oddly gifted, but a disaster when it came to social skills. And a few years later, a specialist said he felt I had autistic characteristics. Like Dr. Temple Grandin, I was blessed with parents who worked with me, and now I find being an Aspie is more of a gift than a negative. The new autism spectrum disorder term doesn't bother me as long as the word spectrum is noted and explained. It's like a rainbow that has many colors, and Aspies are one of the colors. Spend time in Silicon Valley if you want to see a lot of successful Aspies. Julie writes on our website, I think the decision to vote with the science rather than the society was correct. Some of the biggest problems with DSM historically came from the unscientific medicalization of social taboos, example, homosexuality. That being said, the rights and social standing of individuals whose diagnoses have changed must be protected, and I'm crossing my fingers that they'll be helped rather than hurt. And from up in Oysterville, Washington, a listener named Glenn says, I have to ask, what is the objective difference between a set of behaviors that is a disorder and another set that is not? How do the authors of the DSM make this distinction? Is it simply a majority vote based on their own experiences and biases? Is it the decision of an individual's based on their own experiences and biases? Is there an objective difference at all? Well, Sally Rogers, maybe just a succinct explanation of the so-called science that goes into this. I mean, it has to do with clinicians treating patients for the most part, doesn't it?
I think the last comment is a really important one, and it's quite clear in our description of autistic disorder that we're not talking about personality traits that make one person different from another, but there's no objective disability involved. We're talking about people whose function is significantly impaired by their symptoms, that they are having trouble adjusting to school, to work life, to social relationships, that these really are disabilities, that the characteristics are impairing people's function and requiring that they have additional support from many sources, not just the schools. I agree with the comment about the burden needs to be spread across groups. So we are talking about impairments that are limiting people and not personality characteristics or stylistic differences.
And if I could go back to you, Michael John Carley, I've got a listener named Shannon who tweets the following, and I'm interested to hear your response. She quotes puts in quotes the word brilliant. It says, number of Asperger folks usually share serious social and sensory difficulties with all autistics. High-functioning autism equals bunk. That's a tweet.
Could you read that back to me?
Yeah. Yeah. She's saying that there really isn't such a thing as a high-functioning autistic. The fact is that there really is a distinction, and a sharp distinction, between Asperger's and autism.
No, I really don't see it in the big picture. I can certainly see the need to compartmentalize. Again, as I said, you know, an Albert Einstein and somebody that's having difficulty learning how to speak. But, you know, if you look at the entire picture, absolutely not. I'll tell you a little comic, tragic, but very human sort of parallel, which I see sometimes in GRASP support groups. It's a chapter organization, runs like any other, with, chapters in various cities. And let's say at one of our meetings, you know, you might have somebody who, you know, is able to sit through a structured two-hour meeting, but has a lot of stims, usually happening when the person is actually experiencing pleasure, as opposed to, you know, anxiety, which we too often, I think, fear a stim is, and who may have...
Sorry, what is a stim?
A stim is sort of like a bodily reaction that's involuntary, usually... can really happen to folks throughout the spectrum, although to varying degrees. You know, a dramatic example for some people might be flapping of the arms or, making facial gestures, sometimes making noises. Those are referred to as stims, and thank you for asking that question.
And thank you for the clarity.
Not at all.
And for educating me. Yeah.
So let's say in one of our support group meetings, you've got, you know, Joe, who stims, and let's say you've got Jack, who's, you know, a partner at a conservative law firm, and he's got, you know, a wife and four kids. And we very often sometimes see that both sides, both of these two individuals, Joe and Jack, are terrified of one another. Joe is terrified that the notion that he's going to be expected to achieve the level of being a partner at a conservative law firm with a family, or else he's going to be looking like a failure. And sometimes Jack, the lawyer at the law firm, is going to look at Joe and, you know, panic and go, oh, no, that's not me, that's not me. We see this a lot. It's part of the human development that, you know, people, when they're first diagnosed or are starting to meet other people on the spectrum and starting to absorb how complicated this stuff really is that, you know, it's a growing pain. And I think that, you know, the terms high functioning and low functioning, we really kind of need to get away from, because the majority of this population can, you know, read what's being written about them and hear what's being said about them.
Well, there also used to be different categories. I mean, for a while they were talking about, diagnosis,
yep.
Moderate diagnosis, severe diagnosis. And there's the old idea that, you know, you go to three doctors, you can get three different diagnoses.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what's happening is that, you know, there is this debate between itemize it, which is what we've tried to do in the past, and which really is problematic, not just because there isn't any area to itemize, but because people grow. You know, people move from the place on the spectrum that they're born to the place on the spectrum that they're going to be when they die. People really do progress quite dramatically. And, you know, now we're entering this idea where we're trying to be a little bit more loose and kind of put all of our need to compartmentalize in a bubble and blow it away and try to stay a little bit looser and absorb how complicated this stuff really is. I hope you don't mind, though. I need to go back to one point that Dr. Rogers had pointed up about social communication disorder, which I just think is really, really important to emphasize. And I'm a little disappointed that it didn't get communicated, is that social communication disorder, we've been given no indication will qualify somebody for services whatsoever. So if you're a parent out there, and if social communication disorder is a possible diagnosis for your kid, it's not one you want if you're looking for services.
Well,
I
appropriate,
think that's a very important point to
also
point
a very important point, because we're running short on time, is when I think that this next caller has about insurance. Kristen, join us. Hi.
Hi, yes. My name is Kristen, and I was one of the primary drafters of the SB 946, which is California's autism insurance bill. And there's a real critical issue, because this has been a condition that was discriminated against for so long that we actually had to legislate in many states. There are now 32 laws that are specifically only giving services for someone with a diagnosis. And so even on the low end, if you lose services for 10% of individuals, or if you lose a diagnosis, a medical diagnosis, for 10% of individuals, you will lose services for sure because we had to legislate it. Similarly, Medi-Cal excludes autism for mental health services. So if you're going to take all the Asperger's kids who now qualify and put them under autistic disorder in Medi-Cal, they will lose services. They're supposed to get it from the regional center, but they're still going to be too high functioning to qualify for the regional center, so you're going to have a large number. And the social communication disorder will not count as any sort of autism spectrum disorder for insurance, and there is no eligibility for a social communication disorder for school services nor for regional centers. So you're going to end up with some significant portion, whether it's 10% or 50%, seriously at risk for losing their services.
Yeah, thank you for that, Carol. Can I get a quick response, Emily Willingham, from you?
I think that that's a genuine concern, and also I think, I mean, from what I understand, that part of the intent on the DSM-5 committee was that the social communication disorder would capture particularly the PDD-NOS people who were no longer going to qualify for an autism spectrum diagnosis. But I do believe that latest study that I just mentioned from Lord et al., Huerta et al., that identified the 10%, they actually found that they didn't lose the diagnosis because of social communication. I mean, they lost the diagnosis in spite of that, and that the repetition was something that they still showed, but that their social communication was okay.
Well, there are a number of emails and web postings that have come in, and I would urge listeners to go to our website to not only to continue this discussion, but also to see some of the comments that are coming in about specific places and services, kqed.org/forum, or our Facebook page. Let me thank Emily Willingham, who is a freelance science writer and editor and blogs at Forbes and is a parent of an autistic son diagnosed with Asperger's. Michael John Carley, executive director of GRASP and author of Asperger's From the Inside Out. He was diagnosed with Asperger's. Stephen Kapp, who is a PhD student in development psychology. Out of time.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.